This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Judith McCombs. She's the author of 5 books of poetry, and she's an archivist, a scholar, an editor, but first of all, she's a poet. And here she is with a poem.
Thank you, Grace. I'm going to read from the Mother Poems, a sequence I did after my mother's death, and a sequence that I did not read for many years at all because I was too close to it. But when I did read it, people, even guy people, young people, liked it and came up and said so. So, okay, family history. Fathers die upright, walking away where they can, or turning away to the cold white wall and the light, making it plain the visit is over. Mothers go on, stumbling and grasping the walls of narrower rooms where they fumble our names, needing and reaching again from the tangled warmth of the bedclothes, wanting the children who need, the children who grew.
The voice of Judith McCombs. So this is a narrative. It's a book-length narrative, right?
It's a chapbook-length thing.
And would you just describe it to us?
Well, it progresses through time. There's the poems that describe the week in which I was on a night shift at home taking care of Mother. There are the dreams and memories that came afterwards. You know, at first there was the sense that we were still together, although I was back home in Detroit and she was in Oregon. And then after she did die, this was a slow death of cancer. Then the memories started coming back of the time we'd had together and the memories from earlier, and they were a mixed thing. Sometimes she didn't like me, sometimes I didn't like her. And sometimes we were close. But
well, did you take notes during her termination, or was it an after rush? Did you keep a journal, or was it a flush of memory that inspired all these poems?
I can't remember now. It was probably all those things, but more it was waking up with it. Well, I had a tremendous sleep loss from that week, and I probably did take some notes, but I was in no shape to work on them.
Give us another poem, Judith.
Okay. This one's called Denial. There's 2 speakers here. The first is the mother. I'll dig out my road maps and start driving again. We'll get the kids out to the coast. Terminal's just what they say when they want to get paid by the end of the month. Can you use the socks? Take anything you want. I guess you know I won't need them. No, I said, I can't.
Wow, those are utterances that come really cut through. They come right from the heart, struck through the heart. Judith, we get an idea of what this book is going to be about. But when I look back at your canon of work, and your last book was The Habit of Fire, Selected and New Poems, what do you look at and say, here are 5 editions? What is the larger story that I'm telling here? When I look at all of my poetry, what themes have I covered? What am I about?
Maybe bearing witness to the things that I know that became poems, so it includes political poems as well as personal poems. It includes a lot of poems about nature and the wilderness.
You're an environmentalist?
Oh, yes. But there's also poems about Kosovo and Vietnam and so on.
So you would say that
But it's a story of one person and the things that were worth writing, the things that became poems that happened to me.
So experience,
yeah.
Right, from your experience.
Some,
and
yes.
You're very strong.
And from those who I read. You know, there was a time when I was in love with the poems of Theodore Rethke and Anne Sexton. That's my first book. But later on, of course, Margaret Atwood's poetry had some influence on me. And there's a lot of influence by fiction, a whole lot. Cold Mountain had a huge influence.
Her name is Judith McCombs. We're at the Library of Congress, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. And we're proceeding with an unpublished manuscript. This is a premiere we're hearing, and it's going to be a chapbook. And when will that be issued?
Well, I think it can become a chapbook or part of a book, heart of a book.
Maybe a section.
Yes, one of three sections.
Well, take us with you, Judith.
This one's called Endings. I began thinking about, you know, what I knew of such an experience. Endings. First, the cat. Too old to recover. Not claiming her share of the Thanksgiving innards. Not lifting her head for our spoons of cool broth. She hung on, curled in the cupboard over the heat duct, till almost December, when she woke the whole house, thrashing out on the floor, eyes glazed, hitting her head on the fridge. We held her, crooning her name, while the vet found a vein. Then, the plump old woman in a sprig dress, not moving, her hair neatly combed, on the bed by the door of Mother's white room. Poor lady, she hasn't talked once. She's very far gone, Mother said. The interns worked gently, murmuring their reasons for doing what kept the curled body at rest. Her brother just sits there, Mother whispered. He's her only survivor. He hasn't had dinner. She went on to her bedpan story. My youngest stopped pulling on me, and I helped him blow kisses that sailed to her pillow. Like magic, she said, leaning back. She was fed up with doctors and glad we'd be here tomorrow to spring her. It felt strange being the grown-ups that night in her unused kitchen, talking softly about what we could do, dividing her care around the clock. Later, when I bumped my head on the shower and yelled, the youngest got up with his bear to read me a story by heart where everything lived happy forever, though he liked dragons better.
So we have the dying cat. We have the dying mother. Is this difficult for you to read? Do you relive it as you read it, or are you now?
Is this one tries not to.
So you see it as
but
a relic.
One does.
Yeah. Because I can feel that the white heat is still on the page. Yes. When you write a poem, it feels to me as if there's a question at the center of your poetry, that you're searching for an answer. It doesn't seem as if you've set up the poem ahead of time. It seems like you start a poem with a question in your mind of where you're going and a search. So tell us if I'm on track. When you began that poem with a dying cat, what was the question in that poem that you were trying to answer?
I had seen my mother in the hospital by then. She looked very different, though her voice and mind were still strong. And my other experience of nursing anyone who was dying was with the cat. And then, of course, there was the woman who was very near death on the other bed in the room.
Those things are very important because I think if it had just been a straight ahead narrative, we would not have the texture. The way you inserted these episodes, I think, give it the depth and the veils that we needed in the poem. Are you aware of that?
Perhaps I'm too close to it and the memories are too real to me. I mean, I understand what you're saying. It makes sense.
Well, let's go to the next
one. I can't totally be just a reader of these things.
We'll see. We'll listen and we'll see. So read us another.
Okay. This is part of one called In the Week of Your Leaving, when she was very fragile and I was on the night shift. Before you can wake or be frightened again, I'm coming, calling mother and mother, tending what's left of your body. After you are eased, I huddle in your bedside chair, stroking your warmth until you can sleep. All night, our love is a thread, pulling you back to the shallow box of a room where the living hang on. You tug at the thread like a child sliding back in the waters of fever or birth. You belong farther out. All night, on the high white hull of your bed, you are drifting from the ones loving here to the ones who are loving you there. You can see them waiting, mother and sister and Charles. You will have family wherever you are. All night,
You are here and not here, like a traveler patiently bearing so many farewells. Mm. You smile, leaning back as if into depths you have entered. Your two hands cross, and your splinter feet wait, ready to leave.
The high white hall of your bed.
Yes.
What was your relation like with your mother?
I know that my mother, she was the one who got me into college. And when I was, she made sure that her sister, who was going to leave all the money to the boy so he could go to college, that it was split up equally, the two girls and the one boy. And without college, my life would have been very, very different. But also, she liked to sung on the long road trips. Our family traveled a lot in a government surveyor's family.
Well, you're describing her, but what was your relationship?
Well, I'm trying to say what I think. It was good probably until I was 8 or so. And after that, I was callow. But after that, I think she was cross at me. But also my sister was ill. And mother was, she wasn't ill. She had real visual problems and she had real problem doing school, whereas I loved school. And my brother was a boy, so you should have heard my mother. Oh, boy, a boy, a boy.
So it's complex.
It's complex.
Well, that's the good.
Yeah.
That's good for a poet, right? Because it's not sentimental. It isn't not, there's not longing. There's not yearning in here. It's a very complex set of circumstances you're writing about. And I feel a great deal of conflict in your work and a richness, a truth. It's not patting her on the head as she goes out. There is just a bittersweet truth at the heart of these poems, Judith.
Well, she was unbelievably loving that week.
Well, that comes
and
through.
That was not like her towards
so
me.
As she lay dying,
yes.
You got what you wanted.
Well,
let's have another.
No one would want to do that to her.
Let's have another. Judith McCombs is at the Library of Congress. She's an archivist. She is fundamental to the Federal Poets and a longstanding member, a plank owner, I think. She's an editor with WordWorks. She's had 5 books published. She's fundamental with George Washington University's Splendid Wake program, and she's our dear Washington poet.
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to read a sort of, well, this is what happened on the first night home when I was back in Detroit. But I felt she was with me. After I leave first night home, in the night you are there, reaching your hand over the bars of the rented bed, over the crumbled arm propped between us. You have floated out, leaving the pain. You smile. Your deep eyes open. You remember. Your thin hand reaches as mine used to reach when I stroked your silky warm hair till the pain pills worked and you drifted. My arm was braced so it could not fall on the eaten bones if I slipped into sleep. I feel your good hand reach to my farther breast, touching the place where you showed me yours, though you couldn't have lifted your body to reach so far. You are there. Real as the sleeper beside me, touching to warn me, your gray fingers opening, the thin warmth passing from mother to daughter. I call you out loud as your deep eyes close. In the night you were there, I was not afraid.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And then there's a time jump. This is when the memories begin to come back.
After she is gone?
After she had died, yes, not before, and that took a last weeks. Afterwards, sometimes the memory plays tricks. I can't get her to smile in my head. She turns like obstinate clockwork, a doll facing left, facing right, smiling in profile, skipping my place. Hmm. Or it jumps to the times at the end when she's smiling. Her good hand is reaching. Her eyes are all welcome. Her face a gray oval, loving us all. When the ego breaks down, just the soul is left, said the nurse from the hospice. It's good you can talk. Her voice stopped short. She wrote in the chart before saying, very carefully, there hadn't been time with her own mother's dying. Then suddenly she's back, in her own real body. She's standing in sunlight. It's our old living room. And she's grinning and swaying with the silly hula hoop looping around her in those orange popsicle shorts that she made. Why can't she grow up? And it's me who turns away scowling till the hoop spirals down and she stops.
What is the title of this manuscript?
The Mother Poems.
It's a suite. Suite of poems. How many will number altogether?
About 12.
After you finish that, have you finished it?
Yes, I think
okay.
so.
Okay. What was different about you? What did you discover about yourself after the completion of this journey you took? How were you changed?
Well, I didn't know these poems were going to happen. And I suppose I must have gone on with my other writings and with my life. Once in a while I've come back to memories of my mother, but it's memories when she's strong and alive in herself.
Now that's interesting, yeah. But did it not serve as a catharsis of any sort? Did it not make you in a different place emotionally? Did it not cleanse some things and clarify some things? Was it really just an intellectual exercise?
No, it wasn't an intellectual exercise, but I guess...
As a professional poet, though, I think people don't understand this, that we take an experience and we really do transform it. And the transformation is what you do with all poetry.
Well, that's one way to put it. Another way, which is closer to the way I experience, is that... Of course, I work to revise, and that's intellectual. And of course, I read other poets and fiction, but the poems come. I have a lot of echoes in my head. I have a lot of eidetic images in my head, perhaps more so than the average poet.
I would agree. I would agree.
And I know some have spoken of writing poetry as a descent. I suppose that's Jungian. Or mythic, but poetry is by definition both left brain because it's using words, and it's right brain because it's doing something else. And I know I didn't really, it was a big breakthrough as a poet when I could write about my father's death, and I could get lost in time. I would just sit there not knowing and just waiting, or things would come to me in the middle of the night or when I woke up. And that was when my poetry really got good. I know poets, I'm sure Alexander Pope didn't write this way, but I don't read much Pope.
And so you feel that it was they come through your body, really.
Through the right brain. It's like Betty Edwards' story, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. I read that when I was teaching in an arts college, and that is full of right brain people. That's why they went to an arts college, because they're not too good with words.
But you are. So let us take a poem and unravel it.
An unraveling one, okay.
Yeah. Now, is this the one you'd like to unravel?
I'd like to finish the sequence no matter what. But
finish the sequence, and then... We would like you to take a poem apart little by little and see how you put it together. So let's have this poem next.
Okay. Changeling Dream. I have met some people who don't know the folklore about the changeling. That's the baby that the fairies leave with you, and it eats and eats, and it can never love you, and it can never grow up because it's not human. It takes your real baby. There's nothing to be done about it. Changeling Dream, except to get rid of it, of course. At first, she is someone else, another mother I'm standing behind, admiring her pink wool suit and her long, long feet in the real lady's shoes, though she never wore pink or real lady heels. When I reach, by mistake, she blurs, worn wool of no color. She turns to stare, and her scowl comes back. She is braced in her own flat shoes, her pointy arms crossed, because you can't. In the dream, I don't care. I have got my full growth. I am laughing with others. When I wake, it is 2 days before I am born. The wrong glad child to the sad wrong mother. Was 2 days before my birthday when this happened.
That is lovely. I love the mystery in that poem and the folkloric sense of it and the mythology in it. That is really a very, very strong poem. Yeah. Also, it shows a lot of difficulty. Mm-hmm. A lot of difficulty. Was that hard to write?
No, it was one of those poems that was, I had dreamt it, so of course I could write it down.
I wake up and write my dreams, too.
Oh, you do?
Okay. Yeah. So how much of that is by design and how much by chance? I mean, so you woke up and dreamed it, but what, and that was chance. What did you put there that was constructivism? What did you construct there?
I believe that it wasn't chance, that there was, my right brain was it stored and had made this, and it had come to me. The title is what was deliberately changed because I had a terrible title. I think it was something like about a woman, about every woman standing behind her mother.
Terrible.
Yes, that's what all of Lisa Ritchie's writing group told me.
Okay.
So I went home and I put Changeling Dream on the title.
Terrific. Let's have another one. We're really lucky to be here at a premiere of poetry that has not been heard before. You've read some of them publicly.
I read them once at the Norris School.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't cry.
The whole series?
Almost all of them.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, this one's called Burden, which of course means a weight that you're carrying, but it also is the burden of a song. Burden. Oh, I should say that we lived in the Southwest deserts for quite a while, many places when I was a kid. I am carrying the bowl where she fed, bitter herbs, salt, honey, the taste of her life. I am carrying the cloth where she lay, her dark hair veining the white, imprint and pain washed away, the binding, the seams folded shut. I am carrying what is left, her voice in my ears, questions not asked, her eyes at the end gelling over. And before that, her dark dreaming smile, her long arms reaching for babies, her scarred knees that I envied, ashes and shards after fire. Wind lifts in the bowl of the desert, takes what is left, moth wings of ash flecking the cold, shards scattered on sand, filling the tracks of the living and dead, it is ended. O mothers who thicken the earth, be fed and not angry. Be sheltered. Be safe where you wait. And do not come back to the remnants you left. Do not come back with your love.
What do you mean by that?
I think you mean the very end.
Yeah.
It's the wanting to have the person back and not wanting to have her back as I last saw her because she was suffering terribly. And the knowledge that if she came back, we'd be squabbling still.
Oh, it feels like you're saying if you come back with your love, I'm only going to lose you again anyway. That's what I felt when you read that last line. So it's interesting that the listener gets a whole different slant.
Well, no, I did the line breaks so that it's you left, do not, and then it's come back with your love is by itself.
It's a declaration?
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
But you left was something my mother used to say to me very angrily. You left.
Oh, so it's very important to be put
when
in
I went to, but you don't have to know that.
No, it's important because that has a vibe.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has
it
to
does.
Know what that means, but there's some power in that poem I picked up. I picked up huge emotions in that poem.
Yeah.
And there is anger there too.
Yes.
And tough love.
Yeah.
Tough love.
Well, my mother left further than I did. She was the only one who got out of her small Kansas farm and livestock dealing family all the way to depression. She earned her way all the way to New York City, and she never came back to that. But she was really very adventurous. If she had had college, her whole life would have been different. Even if she had had you know, the classes that we have now for seniors, it would have made a huge difference.
Classic story of a strong, brilliant, intelligent woman who was thwarted and by dint of her own energy made something of herself. That's a very,
she
very,
did.
Yeah. It's a very, very moving thing.
Oh, yeah.
And is this a poem?
This is in the series. This is the last one.
Okay.
To end it.
Read it, and then I'm going to ask you a question about it.
Okay. It's called Inside the Color Print. They stand together now, the way they always stood, man and wife. Their bodies softer, worn and leaning towards each other, like the roots of trees ingrown, hand over swollen hand. This is their yard, their path, their warming spring. The noisy young are gone. Light bathes their upturned heads, his shirt, her melon dress. Spring breeze, azaleas, pink and floating white, that trace the boundaries of their home, their settled peace. Somewhere inside, unseen, their last pet jumps and yips, half puppy still, against a shadowed screen.
That is a classic work by Judith McCombs, who is one of our finest poets. And before we end the program, tell us about that poem. Its origin was looking at a photo.
Yes, a color photo.
So you're looking at a color photo, and then what happens to you to write that poem? Do you just say what you see, like Bruegel did in Pictures from Bruegel? Is the process too difficult to describe?
It's wordless, which is what the right brain is. But it was making words. It was a poem I could write with my skills, my verbal skills as a poet at that point in time. And for me, it was a kind of peace to accept the fact that mother and father were quite happy with the noisy young being gone. We were all in different ways difficult. And to see her as she wanted to be seen, as she defined herself.
That's a beautiful notion.
And to understand
her. You ended
her, yes,
by giving her the tribute of showing her the way she wanted to be seen. Happy, in a good partnership, not squabbling with you, beautiful azaleas. So you ended with you tied a beautiful end to that ribbon. You tied a beautiful bow in that ribbon.
Well, and as the poet Gary Stein remarked, it's fitting that this ends, his mother had died also. It's fitting that this ends with photographs because that's what we have left or it's one of the things we have left when people die.
I think that's an epigraph that should be in the front of your book. That's great.
Well, that's an idea.
So we are with Judith McCombs, and we have heard the voice of Judith McCombs. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry, the Reva and David Logan Foundation, additional support by Friend of Poetry, Hiram LaRue. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.